Hello and welcome back to Slightly Fox. September now, and we're all looking forward to the day when we're recording these podcasts round the kitchen table in Hoxton Square again. Not long now, we hope. Now, a few months ago, the wonderful classicist Daisy Dunn gave us a scholarly yet rip-roaring introduction to classical literature. She went from Homer right through to Mary Renault. Now, judging by the listens, thousands of you really loved it. So today, we're digging deep into the past again. Dr. Andy Merrills, Associate Professor of Ancient History at the University of Leicester, will be joining us, and with him as our guide, we're going to try and shed some light on the era once commonly known as the Dark Ages. Editor Gail Perkis is with us. Hi, Gail.
Hello.
What's happening?
Well, I'm just about to send the winter issue off to the printers, and we're also just about to finalise two new publications. We're doing a lovely collection of Countryman's Notes by Adrian Bell on the theme of winter, illustrated by a Suffolk artist called Beth Knight.
Uh-huh.
And we're also publishing a series of letters that were written from a father to his son from February 1945 to October 1947. He was a commercial artist. His name was Charles Philipson. And he wrote his son a letter every day for the first year and then weekly thereafter, partly to help him to learn to read. But each letter was beautifully illustrated, and they depict daily scenes. There's lots of humour in them. He records VE Day, for example, and the peace celebrations.
Right.
School plays, incidents on the way to work. They're utterly charming, and we're producing a facsimile edition. So I'm hoping that'll be a lovely present for people to give at Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Anna Kirk is here too. What are you up to?
Yes, so we have also just completed our series of the Rosemary Sutcliffe titles, children's books, but also for people of all ages. The Shield Ring and Sword Song were both published at the beginning of the month, which completes the set of seven Sutcliffe novels.
And these are really beautiful books, aren't they?
They are. They're fully illustrated, and we have commissioned our own end papers. They are not only exciting reads, but beautiful to hold, and brings it to life with the illustrations as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing those too. Now, as I said, our literary guide to the Dark Ages is a man who's spending his career studying the history of the ancient and early medieval world, Dr. Andy Merrills. Hello, Andy.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us.
It's my very great pleasure.
Can we start with a bit of housekeeping first? Because I've used this term Dark Ages, but as I understand it, that's little used nowadays. Is that right?
That's correct. To the extent that this period was dark, it was dark because of the relative absence of sources compared with the Roman period that came before. But unfortunately, Dark Ages tends to carry a sort of negative connotation, the idea that it's lots of barbarians running around bonking each other on the head. And over the course of the last few years, scholars have nuanced that slightly, and there's a much richer picture of this period.
So what do we call it now? How do we refer to it?
It's variously referred, depending on who you talk to. The standard generic term is late antiquity, and this refers to the period between about 250 and about 750 AD. But for some people, it's the late Roman period. For others, it's the early medieval period or the Byzantine period or even the period of early Islam. So there's a variety of different ways in which this period is understood. And in some senses, that's one of the reasons why it's quite fascinating. It falls between lots of other ways of thinking about the world, lots of kind of other big stories, if you like, that we tell when we do history.
Well, indeed. And I'm thinking actually today, I think we'll probably have to largely take a Western view of these events because we're going to struggle to get our arms around the whole global chronicles of the time.
It would be impossible, I think, yeah. In half an hour or so.
So apologies for that. Shall we start with later historians rather than writers or chroniclers of the time? I thought we might start with a name that's familiar to most people, which is Edward Gibbon, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire.
Yes, and in some ways, Edward Gibbon is the foundational figure in modern scholarship on this period. And he wrote this extraordinary six-volume history of the period, starting in around about the middle of the second century and tracing the history of the Mediterranean world right through to the fall of Constantinople in 1453, so 1,200 years of history. And he was writing in the last quarter of the 18th century, at around about the time when the French Revolution and the American Revolutions were happening and causing their own enormous political upheaval across the world. So in some senses, his great work reflects on the changes that are going on in the world around him.
So why did Gibbon think the Romans lost their grip on the Western world, and I must say I am thinking largely of Britain.
That's a much more difficult question than you would think to answer. The sort of simple point that he made was that it's all about the triumph of barbarism and religion, and that's a phrase that you hear quite a lot. So the rise of the Christian church changing the nature of the Roman state, and the emergence of new barbarian groups developing their power structures in what had been the Western Roman Empire, in places like Spain and France and Italy and the British Isles. In fact, the very fact that he chose to tell the history over the course of 1200 years rather than, say, 200 or 300 years demonstrates that it isn't a simple narrative of decline that he's talking about, but rather one of extraordinary transformation from a Mediterranean empire to a Byzantine empire in the Eastern world and a variety of nation states that were starting to develop in the Western Empire as well. So it was more of a kind of vast panorama of human history in the first millennium and a half AD.
I mean, as you say, it was a colossal, ambitious task. But where did he get his information? What did he base his theories on? Because obviously contemporary sources, which I'm keen to hear about, they are limited. What was there?
There are a variety of historical accounts that survive from the period. So historians who were writing at the time, including a number of chronicles, people writing about, for example, the lives of holy men, a variety of different inscriptions that were written in stone, so things like tombstones, but also dedicatory inscriptions. And now, as modern historians, we have access to modern editions and modern translations of quite a lot of this work. But one of the most impressive things about Gibbon, I think, is that he travelled quite widely within Europe and was reading a lot of these things in the manuscripts that survive, so later medieval copies of these original texts, he was gathering together and piecing together this gigantic jigsaw.
But as you say, these are later medieval copies.
Yep.
So do questions creep in then about interpretation by subsequent chroniclers?
Yes. What we tend to have now are sort of copies of copies of copies.
Yes.
And in some cases, we will have dozens of different versions of the same text. And scholars, especially coming after Gibbon, especially in the 19th century, piece together what the original text might have looked like. But things were much more challenging for Gibbon. He had to figure out what he could from the material available to him.
And how did his decline and fall go down at the time when it was published?
It was generally a phenomenon, as I understand it, when it was first published. Everyone was aware that Gibbon was writing this enormous historical work that was hugely ambitious, and he was an MP at the time. And there's a famous story about another MP asking him a sarcastic question about when are we going to see this great history that you're supposedly writing, Gibbon? But it came out, and it certainly transformed the way in which people in this country thought about the late Roman period and the medieval period, and thought about the writing of history in general. I think Gibbon's work is extremely important as a foundational work of modern historical writing in English, not just the historical understanding of this particular period.
Now, I'm going to admit at this point, I haven't read it. It is on our bookshelves, but I have not tackled it. I'm thinking maybe a retirement project. But Gail, have you read it?
I've not read it, but we did have a very good article in issue 68 by Richard Crockett, who's also a professor of history, who managed to summarise it in about 2,000 words.
I mean, Andy, as I understand it, it's not as dry as one might imagine.
Gibbon is a bit like Marmite in the sense that some people really like him and some people can't really stand him. For people who enjoy his prose, which is quite sumptuous 18th century prose, and I am one of his fans, it's a delight to read, and it's surprising how entertaining it can be. And he has a neat line in wry, ironical asides. But I think he is one of those texts that if you dip your toe in and sample it, you'll realise fairly early on whether this is something that you want to stick with for the next 6 months or whatever it would take to read the whole thing.
Yeah, 6 months sounds about right. So, Andy, I wanted to thank you, actually, for writing an excellent briefing for me for this podcast, because the Dark Ages is certainly not a specialist area of mine.
Oh, you're welcome. I really enjoyed doing it.
Oh, I'm glad. I've noticed you made mention of a historian, was it Marcellinus, in the 4th century? Why did you particularly note him?
Ammianus Marcellinus was a Roman historian who was writing in the 4th century, as you say. He was a soldier who produced a work which is commonly translated as the Later Roman Empire. He called it the Res Gestae, which is kind of a book about stuff. And it's important because he's sort of the last of the classical Latin historians, and he provides a narrative that's perhaps quite familiar to modern readers. The part of his text that survives is an account of the historians, of the emperors of the mid-4th century. And this is a time shortly after the Christianization of the empire. And he provides a really compelling portrait of the political, military and social changes that are going on in the world around him, culminating in a military disaster where the Roman forces were defeated at the Battle of Adrianople in 378. And so in some senses, of all of the texts that survive from this period, Ammianus' history is perhaps the most accessible, and Gibbon relied on him extremely extensively.
Ah, did he? And other sources of note?
There's a variety of different things from this period. Augustine's Confessions was written about 20 years later, which is an extraordinary sort of spiritual autobiography. One or two later accounts which provide a very different sense of how history could be written in this period, including a particular favourite of mine, which was a work by a French bishop called Gregory of Tours, who was writing in the 590s. His histories are not the straightforward military narrative that Ammianus provides, but rather a more fragmented kind of tableau of a changing world in which bishops and saints and nuns and kings are all jostling for influence with one another. It's extremely difficult to follow in places, but really does provide a really kind of provocative portrait of life as it was actually experienced.
Can you give us some examples? Because I know in your briefing you mentioned all sorts of good stuff in there. I think we'd like to hear exactly what's in Gregory of Tours' histories.
There are quite a few. So Gregory himself, as I said, was Bishop of Tours and looked after his diocese very carefully. So he talks at great length about the great patron of the bishopric of Tours, St. Martin, and talks about guarding his relics, various different stories about clerics from nearby Poitiers coming and trying to steal the relics of Martin for their own church. And he also describes other forms.
It's a very Christian thing to do, doesn't it?
It's bizarre, this world of competitive Christianity, or muscular Christianity in a slightly different way in the 6th century. There are other bishops who take things even further, so two bishops called Sagittarius and Salonius, who seem to have been involved in campaigning at the time and rode with their own retinues in support of one of the Frankish kings.
What, and then military campaigning?
Military campaigning, yeah.
Okay.
An account of feuding going on as well. And this gives us a sense of a very violent society, and I think it probably was a very violent society, but at the same time there are also portraits of life as it's actually lived by the nobility or even the peasantry within 6th century Gaul. So I think, in sum, this doesn't necessarily provide us with a neat story about the world of the 6th century, but it does give us some sense of the confusions or the different currents that drew people's lives in this period.
And a bit of social history, by the sound of it, as well, just
yes,
how people lived.
That's absolutely right, yes. And that's one of the reasons why it's so appealing. And it's a text that you can go back to constantly. I first read it as an undergraduate 25 years ago and have read it many, many times since and have annotated my copy extensively. And each time I read it, I find something new and something fascinating about it.
Gail, I think, didn't you have an essay on that one too?
Yes. Andy wrote it for us.
So this is the great thing about the Quarterly, because it'll give you a little introduction to a book that you might otherwise hesitate to tackle or not entirely be sure would be your cup of tea. So yes, tell me again, Gail, it was...
Issue 65, spring last year.
Andy, you mentioned St. Augustine. I mean, that's a name I think a lot of people will know. It would be good to hear a bit more about how he fits into all this as a chronicler of his time.
Augustine was bishop of a city called Hippo on the North African coast of what's now Algeria. And we know about him partly because he wrote an extraordinary amount. Of all of the people writing in this period, he was easily the most prolific. I heard a statistic somewhere that the complete works of Augustine are equivalent to all of the surviving works of Roman literature from the foundation of the city in the 8th century BCE through to 200
Gosh, that's
AD.
Astonishing.
So Augustine was incredibly prolific and was a bishop for around about 40 years, from the end of the 4th century through to 430 when he died. But we know him best, I think, as an individual because of a work called The Confessions, which he wrote shortly after he'd become bishop, in which he describes his upbringing in North Africa, his training as a teacher of rhetoric, coming to Italy and meeting Saint Ambrose there, and his journey to Christianity. And it's sort of an autobiography in the sense that he provides us with lots of details about his infancy and youth and education that we simply don't get in other sources. But it's also a tremendously moving personal spiritual journey in which is addressed to God and in which he talks about his own difficult position within the world. Subsequently, Augustine reflected on the changing world around him, and especially the devastating news of the sack of Rome by the Visigoths in 410. And his response to this was to produce one of the great works of political theory of the medieval period, or the classical period, which is another very long work called The City of God, in which he tried to explain this seismic event, as it seemed to him, in terms of God's wider plan for the universe as a whole. And in that sense, he was trying to make sense of this fissure, if you like, in the historical story in his own way, just as Gibbon was to do 1300 years later.
I would like to hear a bit more about Bede. Now, Bede, I think if people educated in Britain, this is probably one of the very few people writing about this period that we would have heard of, the Venerable Bede. Can you introduce us to him, Andy?
Yes, Bede grew up in Northumberland, close to what's now Newcastle, and became a monk and lived his life in the monastery of Monk Wearmouth Jarrow, and is best known to us for a book that he wrote called The Ecclesiastical History of the English-Speaking Peoples, which he wrote in 731. But he also wrote a huge range of other works, including commentaries on the Bible and his own reflections on science. But the ecclesiastical history provides an important moment in English historical writing. He's the first historian of the English. And in that text, he describes basically Britain after Rome. So what happened in the period after the legions left at the beginning of the 5th century, a period of political uncertainty that even he wasn't too sure about some of the details, but the arrival of the Angles and Saxons and other groups and how they interacted with the existing population, the Britons and the Picts and the inhabitants of Ireland. And his story is especially about the triumph of the church. So the arrival of missions sent by Rome under Augustine of Canterbury at the end of the 6th century, but also the existing British church that existed, especially in Ireland, and the way these interacted in Bede's homeland of Northumberland.
So, I mean, as you say, clearly, obviously, strung about with his own religious ideas, and he's felt to be very unreliable, is he not? Because, of course, he's writing about a period long before his own time.
Much of what he writes is about the 7th and 8th century, so the period that he knew quite well and experienced at first hand, albeit from the perspective of a monastic cloister. He passes over the earlier period quite quickly, but yeah, he's not a tremendously trustworthy source on Britain in the 5th and early 6th century. But he's better than anything else that we have. And consequently, quite a lot of our understanding of early Anglo-Saxon history is built around the armature provided by Bede's ecclesiastical history. That started to change over the course of the last few years, not least because of some extraordinary archaeological discoveries, which allow us to think about society in a way that's perhaps independent of the model that Bede puts forward.
So Gibbon is drawing on all the sources that you've described to us, yes, and arrives at his masterwork. But I understand that in, was it 1971, a rebuttal was published by Peter Brown, who had entirely different ideas.
Not really a rebuttal so much as a complete reimagining. That Peter Brown wrote an extraordinary short book called The World of Late Antiquity in that year, which reframed this period from about 200 to 700 as a period of cultural efflorescence, of social transformation, rather than simply a narrative of decline. He challenged Gibbon's grand political picture and encouraged us instead to think about the new ways in which people thought about the world around them, thought about their relationship to God, thought about their relationships to one another. And in this book, which is short and extremely readable and fabulously well illustrated, Brown creates a different image, if you like, of what was happening in the 3rd, 4th, 5th and 6th centuries, which is much more appealing in some ways, I think, than the account that Gibbon presents. Gibbon's is more of a sort of high history. Brown's is more of a social and cultural history.
And so Gibbon was seeing the period as the end of something, whereas Brown was seeing it as a transition into other things?
Sort of, yeah. What Brown was doing was effectively drawing upon established periods that art historians had been working with for a long time and saying, look, we can think about this period as a worthwhile period in its own right, with its own stories and its own narratives. And for Brown, the most important of these were the triumph of monotheisms, especially Christianity in a variety of different forms, and then at the end of the period, Islam, and how this affected the way in which politics and society, but also culture, was framed. One of the reasons I think that Brown has been so popular, and his is a book that we still set for undergraduates even 50 years after its publication, is that it's a compelling and rewarding portrait of this period. Brown is an extraordinarily accomplished writer. He has an incredible way with metaphors. There's always the kind of gripping feeling that you're reading history as written by somebody who could easily have been a novelist.
Oh, it sounds remarkable. Do you know it, Gail?
No, I don't, but I think it's one for the reading list, definitely.
So I'm going to ask you what may be a foolish question, Andy. Was there any fiction written at this time? I presumably there was oral fiction, there was tale-telling, storytelling, but was any of it actually put down in writing?
Yes. There's a small genre of what we refer to as the ancient Greek novels, which have survived, and these are prose stories that take a form that's very similar to modern novels that were written in Greek in the Eastern Mediterranean between around about the 1st and the 4th centuries. And these structurally are very similar to certain forms of novels today, especially kind of romantic fiction. They typically take the form of two protagonists who are lovers being separated, going on separate adventures and eventually being reconciled.
Well, can I just jump in here? What about all the Icelandic sagas?
Well, I was wondering whether we wanted to get into that or not.
Because, I mean, I know that they were sung or recited, but were they written down at that stage?
They were written down much later. So there is a separate body of sort of oral literature, especially in the vernacular languages, so the Scandinavian languages and the Germanic languages, that we get hints at from time to time, and some of these survive in later copies. So Beowulf is the most obvious example, but it's been possible for scholars to try to piece together the origins of some of these stories as well, and to think about the ways in which these might have been transmitted orally. The other great example are the traditions associated with the Nibelung cycle, which are Germanic oral traditions, especially based around the invasions of Attila the Hun, which are mythologized and turned into oral tradition and then eventually written down.
I mean, obviously, most things weren't written down at this time. Literacy, a rarity, and the commodities of writing stuff down were expensive. But was there any sense in which, fiction wasn't deemed an appropriate thing to write down because it wasn't serious? Writing was for serious factual or spiritual matters.
It's hard to know. Histories are written in this period of the Goths, for example, that trace their origins to the mythic past. So the idea of writing these things down wasn't necessarily anathema to contemporary Christians. One of the problems that we have is not simply about whether or not these things were written down, but whether or not the texts themselves have survived. That we have very, very few manuscripts that survive from the 5th or 6th century. Most are rather later. And so we're always dependent on later copies. So the crucial thing is not only whether something was written down, which might have been quite rare, but also whether people bothered to copy it a couple of hundred years later.
Because in the absence of fiction of the time, many, many books, subsequently reimagining contemporary works focusing on this period. Any favourites?
Gore Vidal's Julian is an obvious favourite, the Emperor Julian the Apostate, who is the last of the pagan Roman emperors. And Gore Vidal novelises this story in a way that's very similar to his later novelistic treatments of the US president and American history of the late 18th and early 19th century, and provides a really kind of compelling novelistic retelling of what was going on in this really peculiar period of religious conflict and change in the middle of the 4th century.
It's a very long novel, and I have to be honest and say that I haven't yet tackled it, but we had a very good article on that in issue 45.
My other favourite novel set in this period is Ian Pearce's Dream of Scipio, which is actually a novel in three parts, one part of which is set in southern Gaul in the 5th century, one part is set in the later medieval period in Gaul, and the last part in the 20th century in the shadow of the Holocaust. And these three stories are interwoven and bound together by a text that was supposedly written by the protagonist of the 5th century narrative. And the manuscript is subsequently rediscovered by the later figures and so on. And each of these individuals is reflecting on their position within a world that is changing around them. And that, for me, really encapsulates some of the difficulties that we have in trying to piece together what life was like in the 5th century, but also some of the complicated ways in which the interpretation of this period has changed.
And was it you, Gail, who mentioned Ishiguro, the buried giant?
Yes, I've been trying to read it, and I have to be honest and say that I've slightly struggled with it. It's set in post-Arthurian England, and it's about an elderly couple called Axel and Beatrice, who go in search of a son who they think that they had. I mean, a lot of the book is about sort of amnesia, both their amnesia and sort of collective amnesia. And they go on a journey and they meet Sir Gawain, one of Arthur's knights, and they come across dragons. And he basically sort of interweaves myths and reality and writes about collective memory. But it's quite a tough read, and I've not yet finished it. For this period, I found the Rosemary Sutcliffes that we've been reissuing far more, well, they're much more concrete, I suppose. They're stories about young people set between the period when the Romans are still in Britain, but they go right through to just after the Norman invasion. And the last three in the series, which we've reissued this year, are very specific and set in a particular place with a particular protagonist, and she manages to recreate the world believably so that you understand this period of clashing between native Britons and these successive waves of Saxons and Vikings. So Dawn Wind, which is the fifth book in the series, is set in the 6th century AD. And it ends with the coming of Augustine of Canterbury and the bringing of Christianity to Britain. And I imagine that most of her detail comes not from written sources, but from archaeological finds. And they're a wonderful evocation of the period, and they feel very authentic. I mean, I don't know whether they are.
Yeah.
And they are incredibly readable, and they have really good stories in them. I mean, you know, they're just dramatic, wonderful characterisation. And although they're supposed to be written for children, as an adult, you know, I've now read each one probably three times in you know, various stages of proofs. And I'm still gripped, you know, on the third or fourth reading.
Yeah, I love them. I've read them years ago, and I'm looking forward to rereading them as an adult, actually. I think I was telling you, Gail, the other day that I had found a book I hadn't come across before. It's a bit late in the period we're talking about, but you were mentioning the Icelandic sagas, and I gather it was based on the tradition of the Icelandic sagas. It's a book called The Longships, and it was written by a Swede called Frans Bengtsson. I think in the 40s.
I'd never heard of him.
Apparently, this was a book that was universally read in Sweden, I mean, for decades, through the second half of the 20th century. It is great fun. It's the exploits of a central character called Orm from youth right through to his old age. It's a bit like Rider Haggard. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, it's dated in the sense that it's a pre-war adventure story. But I've absolutely loved it. It was translated into English in 1943 and then into apparently 23 other languages. So it went worldwide. I would recommend it.
Oh, well, that sounds an extremely good recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, certainly lost and forgotten as far as I was concerned. Anna, did you come up with another one that we hadn't talked about before?
Yeah, I mean, first, just quickly just touch back on Beowulf, because I find it really interesting that it's still such a rich source for kind of reimaginings and kind of a touchstone for creativity. And that I've recently read in a very new translation by Maria Davina Headley. It's a kind of very kind of modern take on it, very colloquial and very fun, fierce. It's been described as, you know, a feminist retelling. It was a very different approach to a well-known text. But I've just read Sister Song by Lucy Holland, which is a retelling of an old British folk ballad called the Two Sisters. And that's set in a magical ancient Britain. So it's 6th century in the ancient kingdom of Demnonia. It's King Cador. It's telling the story of his three daughters, essentially, who inherit his land, which has been abandoned by the Romans. It's torn and fragmented, warring tribes. And it's kind of focused on these three daughters who are kind of fighting against the confinement of the walls of the hold, but also trying to, you know, defend themselves against the invading Saxons. But it's got a lot of magical elements brought in. There's a magician called Merthyn, and I just thought it was it feels like a very contemporary tale, but rooted in, it's like the magic of the land. And it's, again, this kind of tension between that ancient belief system and then Christianity seeping in and taking over. Like the Sutcliffes, it just felt really realistic.
Yeah.
It's interesting, these retellings, they're just still so popular, perhaps because we don't know a huge amount about it.
Yeah.
You can project space, onto it. It. Yeah.
Andy, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, as we say, there's very few texts for you and fellow historians to work from, but a huge canon of later works imagining life at that time. I mean, some of it very heavily researched, and then the mythological stuff sort of thing that Anna's talking about. We're fascinated by this time, aren't we?
Yeah, I think partly because it feels like a foundational period, and this is a period that later kind of European states, including the one that we live in, see as being their kind of point of origin. And so it seems a bit more foundational. The classical world is a little bit distant. It's a bit kind of gods, yes, and myths and things. But this is recognisably a world that we can be familiar with. And I think the fact that there is a limited amount of source material available also means that people feel that they can put their arms around it, that you can kind of know as much as professional historians know about this period, really. So yeah, it's odd to put it like this, but it's an odd combination, I think, between the kind of reality, the kind of tangible reality of a past that we can imagine, but also a kind of mythological world in which, you know, maybe dragons did walk the earth. The darkness created by the absence of sources and perhaps by the absence of familiar historians means that this is an area that's quite easily filled by myth. This is the period where the Nibelungenlied is set, the kind of great story that becomes Wagner's Ring cycle. But this is also a period which has several larger-than-life figures, including Attila the Hun, who was prominent in the 5th century. And as a result of that, there's an extraordinary sort of outpouring of these literary reimaginings, but also different forms of writing. So on my shelf, for example, I have a book called Leadership Secrets of Attila the Hun, which in some ways is typical of the idea that this is a period that we can just sort of grab what we want from.
Yes, those leadership books have been written about pretty well every military commander in history, haven't they? Yes. Grabbing up trite lessons for contemporary business people. Yes.
I mean, we've not even touched on the Arthurian legends, have we?
Not really.
I mean, Andy, Thomas Mowry's book, Mort d'Arthur, was based on oral history, presumably.
Yes, the kind of background to the Arthurian legend is murky, and inevitably the further back you go, the murkier it gets. The earliest accounts that we have are from the 8th or 9th centuries, and they're little more than a kind of single reference to an individual name. And in fact, the earliest reference we have just says this person was no Arthur, which implies that there are stories going around at the time about who the actual Arthur was. Yeah. But we don't know anything about him at all, and it's certainly overwhelmingly likely that there was no historical figure called Arthur, but rather that a variety of different stories started to cohere around an individual figure. And of course, Tolkien drew upon this. Tolkien was an expert in Old English literature. He knew his Arthurian material extremely well. And one of the things that he was wanting to do in The Lord of the Rings was to provide for Britain and England a comparable set of kind of oral traditions to those that he knew so well from the continent in the same period. So again, we see this idea that this is a kind of really fertile ground for sowing these stories, for kind of creating these elaborate semi-mythological worlds.
And it goes on, doesn't it? Because Bernard Cornwell, who's the most terrific story writer, has got a whole series of novels collectively called The Last Kingdom, set in 9th century Britain.
Are these the ones that have been televised?
Yes.
Yeah, I've seen some of these. They're great.
They are rattling good reads. And again, I think, you know, he's a man who does his research. And the BBC series was splendid entertainment.
Just one question, which is probably a foolish one again. Everything we think we know about the Arthurian legends, you know, the names and the round table and all that sort of stuff, when does that actually date from? Was that all just laid over the Arthurian myth much later in history?
Yes, it's later medieval retellings of the Arthurian story. And the Mort d'Arthur is an important stage in that process as well. It's a bit like the stories of Robin Hood. The figures become regularised, the individual kind of figures within the myth become standardised, I suppose, in the constant retelling, and a sort of canonical account emerges. But this is much, much later.
I think that was something of a whistle-stop tour, but I hope people found it interesting. I certainly did. Thank you very much, Andy.
Thank you.
If we've piqued people's interest, where would you suggest they start reading into this period?
I would recommend, first of all, Peter Brown's World of Late Antiquity, just to have a completely fresh look at a period and aspects of a period that you would never have thought possible. And then after that, honestly, jumping into the primary sources, reading Ammianus or Augustine's Confessions or Gregory of Tours, all of which are available in Penguin Classics translations, because I think it's reading the primary sources that we can engage most directly. And again, you know, this is my job, this is what I've been doing for some time now, but I always find going back to the primary sources, there are new things that I haven't seen before, and yeah, sort of feel the century slipping away, engaging with a society that's radically different from our own. And I think that's part of the appeal.
Thanks, Andy. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Anna, we've been thinking about bookish expeditions again, and I think you've got one for us which takes you back to your roots, haven't you?
Yes, we're heading up to Northumberland, where I grew up, which is home to Hadrian's Wall, the mark of Roman military presence, which is, of course, very well known. And there's all sorts of Roman forts and settlements, of which I did a very frequent tour as a child. The English heritage cards were well used. Lots of great walks up there as well. I would definitely recommend walking around Halsteads as well as popping into the museum to get a bit of background. Yes, also, of course, home to Holy Island, Lindisfarne, home to a priory founded by St. Aidan, but very famous for St. Cuthbert, who has become, well, he essentially inspired a saint's cult there. And also, you can learn about the Viking raids on that island, a big bloody barbaric affair, which again goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
And Anna, there is an absolutely marvellous bookshop up that way, isn't there?
Yes, so more of a literary destination, although I would recommend seeing the Lindisfarne Gospels as a beautiful illuminated books. But for perhaps more accessible books, I would head to Barter Books in Alnwick. A very unusual, just enormous bookshop, which is a converted Victorian railway station. And it's just a cavernous place of books, just completely filled. The entrance was the old station parcels room, and it still has the open window where passengers would buy railway tickets. They've put a model railway which runs round above your head as you're browsing.
Yeah.
They've just got every single genre in there. It's very well organised, so you can rummage about.
Is it all still secondhand, Anna, or is there?
Yes, it is, but you know, it's still absolutely crammed with books. Everything that you could be searching for, I'm sure you will find. I took my university reading list there and really did pretty well.
Did you?
So it really does have all sorts of things, as well as just being a lovely place to spend a day. I mean, they have fires in winter, they have a station buffet, a children's room, they've got a big mural featuring famous authors and literary figures, and it's just really comfortable, and you can just spend a whole afternoon there. We used to go there, me and my brothers, and my mum would just give us a fiver or a tenner, and you'd be like, go forth, and then a couple of hours later you'd come back with your big pile.
And look at you now, you see, working in literary publishing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Barter Books is also famous, or became famous about 15 or 20 years ago, for discovering the original of the Keep Calm and Carry On poster. It's in a cardboard box full of other stuff.
That's right, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, it was a planned propaganda poster to be issued during the Second World War by the British government in the event of a German invasion. And they sold individual prints of this poster, which then became incredibly common for about 5 or 10 years, and all sorts of pastiches came off it as well. But yeah, that came from Barter Books too, I think.
Book recommendations. Anna, I think I'm going to start with you.
So I've recently read The Manning Tree Witches by A.K. Blakemore, published by Granta earlier this year. yeah, I just thought it was a great piece of historical fiction. It's set in the mid-17th century during the Civil War, where there is heightened puritanical fervour, fear of damnation. That's kind of the backdrop. And due to the war, Manning Tree is depleted of men.
This is Manning Tree in Essex, is it?
Yes, exactly. And yeah, our heroine is Rebecca West. See it through her eyes. She's daughter of the bawdy Beldam West, who likes a drink and confrontation. She's a great character. But they're pretty poor, on the fringes of the townswomen, and Rebecca's restless, sick of drudgery. And then enter a witchfinder general, Matthew Hopkins, who is a real historical figure.
Yes.
He comes to the town, whips up suspicion about the women of the margins, particularly, building this hysteria. Both Rebecca and her mother are arrested for witchcraft. And then essentially we're into the fever and menace of the Essex witch trials. And it's kind of an exploration of misogyny disguised as and bound up in religious fervour. And it's, of course, a fictional account, but one that wishes to give voice to the previously muted women.
But the witch trials were a historical event, were they, Anna?
Yes, exactly. And the Essex witch trials have been documented. And I think that A.K. Blakemore used quite a lot of records as inspiration for these characters. And yeah, it's kind of looking at the effects of poverty within a community. There's a clear hierarchy, and they throw up jealousies, resentments, class judgments. It's kind of that small community under the microscope. Yeah. And yeah, looks at the threat, both perceived and real, of these women when left alone together and then kind of facing these accusations. But, you know, they can't win. For instance, Rebecca argues, how can they provide an alibi if they can supposedly be in two places at once because transportating through magical means? But yeah, it is unsettling and dark, but it's also witty and kind of full of life. Rebecca and her mother are completely well realised, and it wears its research lightly. And it's also just beautiful language. A.K. Blakemore, she's a published poet, so there's just beautiful turns of phrase. If you want to be steeped in that period of history, I would definitely head to The Manning Tree Witches.
Thank you. Andy, what have you got for us?
I'd like to recommend three books if I could get away with it, but they are connected. The Balkan Trilogy by Olivia Manning.
Uh-huh.
Great Fortune, Spoilt City and Friends and Heroes. And they're also historical fiction, but set in a somewhat later period, the start of the Second World War. And they trace the fortunes of a young married couple called Guy and Harriet Pringle, who are living in Bucharest during the early months of the war under the shadow of the expanding occupation of Europe. And it traces them in the community of English expats in that city, their movement to Athens. And they're fabulously compelling. I plucked these off the shelf more or less at random during the dark days of lockdown and found myself utterly gripped almost immediately from the start. The stories are told from the perspective of Harriet, who finds herself somewhat lonely because Guy is this tremendously gregarious individual who gets on very well with everyone. But she's surrounded by people who are sort of affectionate, but also frequently kind of grotesque. And over the course of the novels, we get individuals kind of cycling in and out of their orbit. And it made me think a little bit of a kind of slightly more accessible version of Anthony Pohl's Dance to the Music of Time. And when they get to Egypt, there are also kind of shades of Lawrence Durrell and the Alexandria Quartet as well, but a bit less purple than that. So I've just thoroughly loved them, and I will be bereft when I finally finish them.
They're actually semi-autobiographical, aren't they, Andy? I mean, very much what she herself went through.
Yeah, I believe so. So she was writing huge chunks of her own life here.
Thank you. I think we're done for this month. Many thanks, Andy. It's been really great having you with us. Thank you.
Thanks. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. We'll be back in October. In the meantime, as usual, you find all the books and the writers we mentioned on the website, foxquarterly.com. If you find yourself with a spare moment, you might very kindly rate, review and share the podcast for us. Until next month, thanks for listening and for joining us on another literary trek of the beaten track.